Please be seated. It's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, who is no stranger to us. Jim Armstrong is a poet and scholar who taught creative writing at Winona State for 25 years. He is the author of 3 books of poetry, the founder of the Maria Faust Sonnet Contest, and has served as Winona's first poet laureate. Good morning and welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Dwayne, and thanks, everybody. Thanks, friends, for inviting me to talk about the creative life and my relationship to it. I'm reminded today of my parents, powerfully reminded of them. They were both Presbyterians, and in one of the things that they were required to do as kind of elders and deacons in their church was to give a sermon called "This I Believe." Okay, those confessions. And I, as I was sitting here, I thought, "Oh man, that's what I'm doing today, giving my confession of faith." I want to begin today with the poem "The Annunciation," which is from my first book. And I will say that what this talk consists of, I worked really hard to get myself down to like 16 minutes because I remember being on the Sunday service committee, and I see that I have a lot more than that, so I assume you'll ask me some questions at the end. But I want to talk about 3 poems and give some context for that and how these poems relate to my life. I begin with the poem, "The Annunciation," which is from my first book. The title refers to the moment in the Bible when the Virgin Mary is visited by the angel Gabriel. The Annunciation. I always felt you were real, even in school, when others talked of the dialectics of capital, the sexual struggle, the fragments of each hour moved in my watch with a skeletal whisper. I heard your wingtips dragging the ceiling, the rustle of linen as you bent lower and peered into the face of a local girl drunk on the scent of beeswax. She was not frightened, just empty. She had expected a message, but you were disturbingly literal, holding a lily whose mouth was a star of sorrow. A flutter of Latin rippled in midair above you. It read, when we translated it, "Beware, my sweet mouth, the beeswax, the rustle of gowns." Of course, it was too late. From the moment you entered, she was yours utterly, as I was. The two of us set off immediately, without our coats, along the way of sorrows. This is a very strange diversion of the biblical story. Why are the Virgin Mary and I together in this scene? Why is the angel warning us against the sensual aesthetic qualities of the moment? And why are we beginning a journey which seems both thrilling and tragic? When I look at this poem now, it is clear that the subject is the completion of my doctorate at Boston University in the mid-1990s. When Laura and I were first married, she was pursuing her master's at BU, which meant to be with her, I had to move from Kalamazoo to Boston. I was 33. I had spent my 20s conflicted between my perceived duty to be practical and grown up and my desire to write poetry, a desire that began in grade school and continued through high school and college, but was consistently hampered by a lack of faith in my talent and in my purpose. My writing skills had gotten me a job with corporate communications for the Upjohn Company, now non-existent, many of you may remember it, pharmaceutical company. For a while, I was living the Severance lifestyle, if you have been watching that Apple TV movie series. I was a corporate hack for Big Pharma by day and a would-be poet by night, and there seemed no connection between the two. I pursued a night school MFA degree, which gave me the I didn't belong in the world of businessmen who seemed shallow and venal, or to the world of small-town bohemians who seemed pretentious and impractical. Most of all, I felt vastly ignorant. I had heard that to get a doctoral degree in English, I would have to pass an oral exam based on an extensive reading list. This sounded like my chance. I went to graduate school the way some young men join the Marines. I wanted a boot camp to whip me into shape. Every good PhD thesis is a personal quest. Mine certainly was. I ended up focusing on Ralph Waldo Emerson, poet, essayist, philosopher, and one of the founders of modern Unitarianism. Specifically, I looked at Emerson's early crisis of confidence over his desire to be a poet. When Emerson attended Harvard between 1817 and 1821, students were encouraged to embrace reason and British empiricism and reject the imagination as febrile and feminine, imaginative work cycle Frenchmen like Rousseau. The imagination was, as Bacon put it, a false light. I studied Emerson's college curriculum with its emphasis on Newtonian science and unemotional theology. I read his journals and saw how tortured he was by his poetic ambitions. I learned that Emerson had benefited from extracurricular exposure to English romantic poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge, who were kind of the Beats of his day, not on their curriculum, very much discouraged by the reviewers of the Edinburgh Review. He benefited from extracurricular exposure to these poets and also to the new philosophical ideas they brought out of Germany. I saw Emerson use philosophy to think his way out of a limited and starved idea of what the imagination was or could be, and step forward to become the thinker and poet he was hoping to be. What Emerson had grasped was the validity of the imagination. The Romantics saw that human reason was not pattern recognition, not passive mirroring of a material order, but creative construction. Our knowledge of the world, they thought and knew, consists of the imaginative stories and maps we create to make sense of our environment. Our experience is artistic at its core. What the artist does with his or her medium is a heightened example of what we all do in our daily lives. We shape and form experience into meanings, crucially, in dialogue with others. As John Dewey says, in art as experience, art is the most direct and complete manifestation there is of experience as experience. It is experience in its integrity. This puts poetry on a much more solid footing. After I finished writing my thesis, like Emerson, I declared my emancipation from a bloodless and shallow version of reality and embraced finally my life as a poet and a teacher of creative writing, a life I have pursued for 30 years. Poetry is a way of thinking. Poetry takes us back to our embodied, socially situated, morally complex lives. For 30 years, I've preached that gospel and tried to follow it in my daily life, and it has rewarded me with an ever-deepening relationship to my own imagination. The poet Adrienne Rich describes the sense of growth very clearly. It's a fairly long quote, but I think it's the best description I've come across yet of what this life that I live is like. Today, she said, I have to say that what I know through making poems. Like the novelist who finds that his characters begin to have a life of their own and to demand certain experiences, I find that I can no longer go to write a poem with a neat handful of materials and express those materials according to a prior plan. The poem itself, without for one moment turning my back on conscious choice and selection, I have been increasingly willing to let the unconscious offer its materials, to listen to more than one voice of a single idea. Perhaps a simple way of putting it would be to say that instead of poems about experiences, I am getting poems that are experiences, that contribute to my knowledge and my emotional life, even while they reflect and assimilate it. In my earlier poems, and I'm still quoting Lee, as I knew how, about something. In the more recent poems, something is happening. Something has happened to me, and if I have been a good parent to the poem, something will happen to you who read it. If we return to my poem, The Annunciation, we might now see that what lurks at the heart of it is the idea that the sensuous world presents us with images and events which cause us to rethink, reframe, and reevaluate experience. The resulting new meaning feels like, to use Dewey's phrase, an impregnation with imaginative values. Undoubtedly, that's why my mind went to the image of being confronted by an angel. Like Mary, I was being called to go forth and to give birth. Why is this an endless journey on the way of sorrows, though? Well, to come down on the side of embodied imagination is to fully experience death and change. There is no heavenly stasis, no ideological endpoint. What is the artistic life? Consulting the imagination daily, seeking its power to generate meaning by enlisting the full complications of experience. Every day I take my coffee up to my study and I sit with a pen and notebook. I begin to write, by which I mean I begin to listen, expecting to be surprised because, as Rich says, I am willing to let the unconscious offer its materials. To be surprised by how the imagination talks back through its entanglement with a medium is the essence of the artistic life. In my case, of course, that medium is words, but it might also be paint or musical instruments or one's own body in dance. The excitement of discovery that this entails explains our enthusiasm for our daily encounters. As Robert Frost said, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. And surprise is connected to our notion that creativity is the font of innovation. But not all surprises are pleasing. The next poem from my most recent book was written one day after Joe Biden was officially elected as president, when the count was finalized, I should say. My conscious self was deeply relieved and joyful. My unconscious self surprised me. The Count, November 8, 2020. And I should say that one of the contexts for this, many of you know, Laura and I walk around Lake Winona every morning. So this was a morning walking around Lake Winona as usual. The Count, November 8, 2020. An eagle in a tree halfway up the bluff. At this distance, a grain of rice. But once I've seen it, I can find it again. Last night, speeches out of Wilmington, fireworks. A flight of drones spelled out the politician's name against the Atlantic darkness. This morning is weirdly calm. The sun casts long shadows across orange hills. The still lake trembles at the cartwheel of a leaf. All I can think of is a friend who sat once in a pre-dawn Michigan wood, shotgun across his lap. Light filled the spaces between bare treetops. A chickadee tried out a call. My friend reached to scratch his neck, and the morning exploded, throwing splinters and bark 2 inches from his head. Some idiot downrange, drunk or half blind. What my friend couldn't shake for a long time, the thud of that decision burrowing into heartwood. Why this dark image? My imagination felt the near miss was more salient than the narrow victory. It saw the Trump movement was, through blindness and inebriation, threatening the heartwood. The poem seems more meaningful now than when it first was written. There is a big difference between the imagination and fantasy. As Dewey says, in fantasy, the material does not offer enough resistances. The mind plays with it capriciously. Fantasy is an escape from complexity. Its products are colorful, diverting, but ultimately peddle immature ideas about how the world actually works. Think romance novels, religious kitsch, or any Trump rally. The artistic imagination is capable of creative empathy, which sees into the real and often tragic complexities of people and relationships. Much of what I do in the rewriting process, aesthetic design, deepen and complicate my relationship with the world, or does it deny death and change, blur moral responsibility, perpetuate falsehoods? Is it propaganda for the ego or the nation state? Art is never far from moral judgment, which is why we have art critics. But the process has a goal: to better adapt thinking to reality. As John Dewey said, to adventure beyond restatements of convention, to grasp undisclosed opportunities and to generate new ideals and ends, creating new relationships for thought and for action. Here is my third example, a poem written about a specific painting, one which used to hang in Winona, Washington Crossing the Delaware. This is a work many people have appropriated to illustrate a pseudo-religious view of America's founding. Many treat it almost as a photograph, though everything in it was made up by the artist Emanuel Leutze in Germany in 1851. To Washington, crossing the Delaware. Dear General, never stand up in a boat. Is good advice I learned in scout camp. Especially true in December, in the dark, in a river knocking with ice. History paints with a mythic eye. Your priapic sword and flapping cape, your Napoleonic waistcoat, your destiny-fastened gaze. Leutze imagined these on the faraway Rhine. German art students stood in for patriots, shivering, hatless, some without gloves or shoes, some armed with fowling pieces and frontier muskets, eager to assert their independence by obeying a leader. Leutze added moongleam to your military pigtail. Dear General, you did a good deed by not becoming our emperor. We won't mention your China teacups, your slaves. Engagement, historically imagined perspective, it uses a conversation with a dead president to give a complicated counter-narrative to block the shallow appropriation of an image, to deepen and complicate the situation. Feeling our way with discerning imagination through a tangled web of relationships. That is the mission of great art. No matter how tainted with the power politics of the moment, no matter how blinded by ideology and the desire for an escape from reality, the imagination will, if consulted, complicate the picture. I will stake my life on that. Oh, certainly. I think that's an old identification, right? That the spiritual, of course, what do we mean by spiritual? Probably the imagination. I think one of the most interesting things about my study, which I didn't stick in the piece here, was that one of the ways Emerson was instructed to escape from from his bad teaching was that one of the founders of Unitarianism, Channing, William Ellery Channing, I think, was one of the first to say that we can find the Word of God in texts other than the Bible, that imaginative writing of all kinds offers spiritual comfort and information. And so that has been and continues to be, of course, a big part of Unitarianism, but it's also a huge part of Romanticism. So yes, most of my spiritual experiences come through experiencing texts, poems, novels, or movies, or dance, or music. I mean, that's where we get the spirit, right?
I'm going to pass the mic over. I have an exciting person to hand this mic off to. She's one of my former students, a wonderful young lady, Coco.
I'm Coco, or Colette, but Coco's easier. I also write poetry. I love it. And I would really like to know how you got started sharing poetry, because that's a big thing that I want to do. I just get inspired by poetry. When I start writing, I write. But I don't really know how to share that with the public besides like making a video on social media or something. But
yeah, right.
So I would just love to know how you kind of got into that and branched out into sharing it with the public.
Well, yes, I think that's super important. And one of the things you probably want to do is start a group of writers to hang out with if you don't have one already. And because sharing poetry with each other, I mean, that's how I've grown as a poet. I've been in a poetry group off and on in this town for 30 years. And before that, one of the purposes of the MFA degree is to kind of give you a community of writers to belong to. Because in America, in Paris, the story goes, in Paris, in France, if you want to be a poet, you go to Paris and you hang out in cafes and then meet a bunch of dudes and write a manifesto and start a poetic movement. America is too decentralized and too vast. It's hard to do that. But what's happened over the past 50 years in America is the growth of regional poetry groups and centers. I mean, Minnesota is a great example. Thanks largely to Robert Bly, our native poet. There's a tremendous poetry scene in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And there's one here in town. As a matter of fact, you can come and see the First Tuesday Laureate group, which usually will have either a poet or a creative writer of some sort. But it really, building your own community out of finding people that read poetry and that want to share and talk about poetry. But of course, in my case, a lot of it was going to school to get an MFA, which is problematic in some ways, right? But
Jim, would it be okay if I asked Colette to read one of her poems? Is that okay? I asked her before.
I constantly have angels singing in my mind. They share their praises and move me in a way that can't be defined. They say I'm beautiful, kind, and simply divine. That my soul shines so bright because it was made by design. Harmonies flooding my veins, leaving notes in my mind. My soul burns with a passion like an eternal flame for artistry of all kinds. Music flows through me so smoothly, you would think it's in my blood. Weaved into my DNA, I was crafted for melodies to take a hold of. I must have butterflies in my heart, the way it flutters and beats so eloquently, the way they caress my nectar soul so delicately and spread their beautiful colors throughout my energy. I have a way with the trees. They teach me not to fight, but sway with the breeze. They give me life and air to put my soul at ease. And they show me that beautiful things can grow where they once were deceased. My smile shines bright like the sun, and my eyes twinkle like the stars. My mind and body shakes of my heart. And though my mind may feel overwhelmed at times, like a scattered shadow running from the sun, this prophet heart of mine is always leading my path with fleeting whispers of amazing things yet to come.
Thank you for sharing that. Angels and prophets. There we go.
Thank you so much, Colette. We have the old pro on, then we have the young up-and-coming poet. Thank you, Colette.
I'm going to try to be coherent here. In our culture in the United States, unlike many other cultures, poetry is something that is almost academic and removed, and I think many people, myself, a huge part of my life was very intimidated by it. And then you listen to people with such eloquence as yourself, and you hear the word MFA, and you know, a young woman who reads her poetry, which I could hear your voice shaking, and I understand why. There's that intimidation. And how do you speak to that, like, within our culture? Why is poetry so... What are your observations about the remove of poetry as being something rare, non-intellectual, non-academic person?
Well, okay, so that's a very complicated story, one of which is that there was a there was a time at the beginning of the 20th century when American poetry was very popular. There was a counter movement to academicize poetry, to make it a profession, which, for complicated reasons, I mean, difficult to really go into that easily, but there's always a struggle in art between folk and popular art and the art of the elite. You know, there's a struggle between Grandma Moses and, you know, the French Academy, let's just say, between simple, between art that comes from the people and art that is shaped and honed and trained on classical examples and given a great deal of subsidy. You know, what's the difference between polka and ballet, right? Some of that can be really amazing because when you put a lot of work, training, and resources into classical music, you have this fantastic thing called the Minnesota Orchestra, which I go to see like twice a month. But I play guitar and I play folk songs. That's my music. And that is not something that I had to, you know, go to school for 10 years to learn. Nonetheless, when I play my guitar, I get better, and I have a lot of guitarists that I listen to, a lot of musicians that I listen to in my attempt to get better. It's always this kind of relationship between stuff that's, like, for instance, poetry. Poetry's made out of words. We all speak them. And to some extent, every day, you are speaking beautiful words. You're choosing one word over another. You're remembering beautiful patterns that you've heard. And that's where poetry comes from. And then, of course, there's the whole 1,000, 2,000 year history of poetry. There are, you know, like, do we all want to read Paradise Lost but write poetry? but that big, expansive world of world culture and world achievement, which contains, you know, these extremely erudite, as you say, intellectualized, perhaps, products, and also the simplest of chance. Or what has happened, I think, in our educational system is there is a severe disconnect between what's taught in high school and what's actually happening. There are thousands and thousands of American poets. There are thousands of books of poetry. Every year I go to the Associated Writing Programs convention, which is, there's a book fair that's held in a room the size of a football stadium, full of poets. And one of those poems, one of those poets will be your poet that you will not feel intimidated by and you will love. How does that get to you, though? How do we get from the extreme fertility and creativity of American poetry right now to you? Where's the bottleneck? That's the real question, I think. Does that make sense? Like, there are all these poets working right now in Minnesota who are amazing, but have you ever heard of them? Well, they're not reviewed in
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
That's poetry.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's people.
Right.
Poetry. Yeah.
And most pop music is informed by popular poetry, or, you know, like most songwriters read poetry. And if you don't know about it, it's partly this, again, this bottleneck between poetry doesn't make money. You know, you can write a novel, it'll be turned into a movie, and you get millions of dollars. You write a poem, it'll never be a movie, and so it's not monetizable. That's one problem, yeah.
So, I guess going back to your near-miss poem, do you personally find the act of, like, making the art a form of personal processing, or more a form of a need to communicate a message? And how does that relate to, I guess, your view of your role in these times?
Well, we get back to the question of spirituality, right? That it's my communication with something much larger than myself. And my great model is the poet William Stafford, who was put in a prison camp by his own government because he was a conscientious objector in World War II. Imagine that one. And they were put in work camps, the COs. They weren't horrible, work and write before the bugle call. And he called that self-repair, right? And that's how I feel about it. It is a moment of deep, calm self-repair, especially now.
This sort of picks up a couple themes, but I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between that process of discovery and the poem living in you and giving it, you know, sort of, and how does, you know, how do they relate to each other? Does one kind of enable the other, and what does that feel like for you?
Thank you. That's a really good way of reframing that original question from Coco, right? What do you do if you're a young poet? You should read about 10,000 books of poetry. Just like if you're a young musician, you listen to every song you can get your hands. You got your Spotify account nowadays. I was going to say you have a whole bunch of records, but now, whatever. You need to learn your craft. Your craft is learned by experiencing all the poems that are being written right now that are powerful to you, and you want to say, how do I do that? So there's that craft aspect, and maybe that gets to your question too, that there's the craft of being a world-class violinist, and there's a craft of being a guitar player in Winona. Those are all part of a continuum, but you have to learn your craft to do a good job. So there's that education aspect of it and a willingness to constantly improve. That is a huge part of art.
Thank you.